Thanks for downloading this podcast, which is for personal use only. All contents are copyright Radio Show Limited and must not be reproduced, rebroadcast, or used in any form without permission. For contact details, go to www.radiolemon.com. Midweek Motorsport, your weekly window on the world of racing. Formula One, sports cars, American racing, world rally, touring cars, karting, off-road and bikes. If it has wheels and they keep score, it's on Midweek Motorsport, every Wednesday evening from 8 p.m.
So welcome, Nick.
Hello.
Have you finished? Do you know?
Yes, sometimes when you've got a distance to come, you have to eat before you can cogitate on the world of motorsport.
Yes, indeed. And obviously we've had Matt and Eve in to do the first part
of
the
show. Yeah, I don't like experts, you know that.
Yeah, that's very true. Right, but you have rubbed shoulders briefly with the European champion as he went out the door.
Hang on, he was on my team. Was he on whose team was he in the Christmas quiz?
Ah, you see how quickly you forget.
He was on my team in the Christmas quiz.
Bit of Formula One news to start.
Go on, then.
We did have the World Council last week, so we've got a bunch of calendars to do. We're not going to go into a huge amount of detail.
We're not doing European Jag Racing then.
Well, no, because Tim is our calendar expert, isn't he?
He's our calendar girl. To quote Neil Sedaka.
However, McLaren have said F1's expansion will not cause a significant headache.
There's 22 events. We talked about
how many of the 22 will actually happen, though?
Well, I think 19 are nailed on. The three question marks are Korea, which of course happens this weekend, and their problem is that it's not really causing like they wanted it to, and they're being asked to take a date in about 7 months' time because they're moving from the back end of the season to the front end of the season. Mexico, which is a perennial one of two, perhaps with Russia and Brazil, the countries appeared on most calendars but not appeared in actually an event. They rushed to this one as well, of course. And New Jersey, which is insisting it can do it. Now, A22 is a ridiculous number. We're getting close to ludicrous chase levels now of races.
The race for the chase for the cup for the F1 thing.
It would be, yeah, basically. And pretty soon they'll be splitting the fields and that sort of stuff. And they'll having, you know, everyone will be doing full course cautions and they'll be banning crew chiefs. It'd be quite funny, actually, if Horner got banned.
They also wouldn't be able to have all those screens either. That would be good.
That's a good point, yeah. Mm. Five wheel nuts on each wheel. That would slow down the pit stops.
Not a bad thing.
I think probably we're going to end up with, you know, they seem quite confident we'll get 20, but I mean the question mark is over New Jersey, obviously, and the second question mark is over Mexico. If Carlos Slim gets involved, the richest man in the world, there'll be no issue whatsoever. But and I'm pretty certain that Sergio Perez is pretty desperate for Mexico to happen because his position is a bit wobbly all of a sudden with McLaren.
Is Formula One in danger then of becoming too ubiquitous?
Yes.
It's been for the last
This year had 19, thanks to one dropping out, New Jersey, and that was fine. I mean, I think even now, I mean, if you think about it, you leave Europe,
honestly,
and you've still got seven races to go, and that's ridiculous. But we used to leave Europe with a maximum of three.
Well, the only good thing about it is it has saved some of the European circuits and dates.
Well, no, because I think what's happening now is some of the Brave New World's dropping out as well, aren't we? You see, like Korea, I think, won't last much longer, and India won't last much longer.
Do you think?
No, they've
But I think we've still got Russia.
Russia's Europe, though?
Yes.
So it's a European race. Mexico came back. Yeah, the Mexico's got a lot.
I can't see that happening, if I'm honest. No. It's the build-up to Korea this weekend.
Yes.
Of course.
And everyone's really got very... what's happened now is everyone's given up because it got boring. We know who's going to win. Mm-hmm. About four races ago, we're like, oh, yes, it was quite exciting. And now they're going, yeah. No one's going to turn around and say this is the greatest season ever. Mm. What's happened now, though, is that people have started trying to work out if Red Bull have been cheating.
Well,
I've seen two separate items about how they might have been cheating on various blogs in the last week.
Including Giancarlo Minardi,
yeah,
who is absolutely positive
they've got traction control.
They've got traction. At least Sebastian Vettel has traction control.
Yes. And there's also a thing as well saying they may have a illegal exhaust blowing as well, and you know, using the engine to exhaust blow. So there's plenty of rumour and counter-rumour, and I think what happened was, of course, for the first time this year, they completely showed their hand coming off the safety car in Singapore, and they were 2 seconds a lap quicker. Mm-hmm. The the cars is better than the other cars. The other cars, their traditional rivals are McLaren and Ferrari. Ferrari have designed an average car, and McLaren have decided to design a complete dud. So you start off best, and your two rivals cock up. It gets rather easy.
So pretty quiet on the F1 front, apart from the fact that we do have a race this weekend.
There's the
weekend.
Normal statement that so-and-so must drive well, and so-and-so must do this.
Let's
and
not
this,
bother this, with this. That.
Hopefully something will be announced quite soon. Quite good, an actual announcement.
So we're talking sort of calendars next week from FIA, and Tim will be wanting us to go through all of them, I'm sure.
Really?
But there is a story that's come out of the FIM, which is quite tasty. And this
Federation
one,
International Motorcycle.
I don't understand, because Laguna Seca, who've had a MotoGP race every year since 88, and has been on the schedule every year since 2005, has not been able to secure a spot on the calendar for next year, and it would seem purely financial reasons.
Well, I think there's two issues. Issue one is, of course, there are now three races in America, because we have Indianapolis and Texas. The second issue, of course, is Laguna Seca, due to its limited paddock space, can only host the big bikes and not the whole circus. Mm-hmm. And for a homogenised series, that's not necessarily the best idea. They might say, Dorna might, I think it's quite good, personally, and it's a great track.
It is.
So I think they are trying to say it's financial. They're not trying to point out they don't want the race to America, because everyone turns around and goes, hang on, how come you got four races in Spain then?
Well, hang on. At this time, this is what's come out of there. The Master Race with Laguna Seca statement says, at this time the US apparently is only able to support two MotoGP events, and the support provided by the states of Texas and Indiana make it difficult for us as a not-for-profit to currently compete. And people forget that Master Raceway Laguna Seca is owned by local residents.
Yeah.
It's SCRAMP, and that's the acronym for it. Charles Dressing and I are trying to work out an acronym that spells acronym, by the way. And it is a not-for-profit organisation, so they don't have big inducements. What they have is a really good racetrack, and in fairness, a decent crowd, and people want to go there. And want to race there.
But obviously, you know, I think the MotoGP calendar is interesting, because it is horrendously biased towards Spain, and I think the Italians have got three, haven't they, or something. But then again, that's where the riders come from in many ways, and they can get the crowds. They're looking at expansionism. They've got some American circuits, but they want to take two, and they want two where the complete package goes, one, two, and three, MotoGP, Moto2, Moto3. Mm. It's very disappointing, because it was a great race at Laguna Seca, but I think I'd like to see them cut a couple of the Spanish races and perhaps look somewhere else. But
Argentina, Temas de Rio Hondo circuit, didn't get it this year due to political rows, and the provisional calendar for 14, we are expecting to see that
they
happening.
They went down to the test, didn't they, in Argentina? Mm-hmm. The works
a few
teams
did, yeah.
So it's a good chance that'll turn up.
Anything else that we need to talk to about bikes? You watched the weekend?
There was a race, yes, Aragon. Mark Marquez had a coming together with Danny Pedrosa, and Pedrosa's calling foul, and it just hard, and he fell off because he's rubbish. Sorry, because he's Danny Pedrosa.
No, it was a bit tough. Back to Formula One? Or no?
Whatever, not. Have you got something for Formula One?
Not really. It all is rather poo, to be honest, in terms of what's coming out this weekend. Sorotkin's had a go of a Formula One car. He's supposed to be driving for Sauber next year, but he hasn't got a super licence yet.
He'll get a super licence.
Do you think he will?
I mean, I think about the 22 race calendar, John, is remember that in-season testing is back next year.
Yes, that's true.
So there's
true.
Four in-season tests, so there's going to be an awful lot of, whether they're going to start looking at two teams, and the money goes up, and it's all an interesting situation. I think it's getting.
To tell you what we should talk about is the election, the FIA presidential election.
Yes, that's
something that we have followed here over the years.
I think the main thing we found out was, my God, is it 4 years so quickly?
Unbelievable. Now there's a bit of a row brewing up here about how Jean Todt is gaining letters of support from various unions and associations.
We had this same round last time, didn't we? We were supposed to have used the plane for reasons he shouldn't have done. You know, he was flying around. It's interesting, really, because David Ward, who is the competitor, the Brit.
The challenger, yeah.
And kind of said he was only kind of challenging for a bit of a laugh, you know, just challenging for a bit of a laugh, just to, you know, and so we can bring these things out in the air and have an actual election rather than a coronation. He's got in quite hard, really, hasn't he?
Well, we've got a situation where El Salvador apparently holds the casting vote for the whole of the Americas at the moment, which is a bit bizarre.
Eh?
Well, I don't know. There's something really odd. I read.
Is it block voting, is it now? Well, is it like the unions in the 70s?
Well, and a bit like the Eurovision Song Contest. You know,
they all vote with their friends, are they?
There's a requirement for candidates to have support from a number of clubs.
Right.
And Todd has locked down support from 11 of the 12 North American clubs during a meeting in Montevideo earlier in the year. So the fate of that election has been left in El Salvador's hands. So if the club, that club could not only prevent any rival standing against Todd, but if it backs a rival, there's no opportunity for a third candidate to be put forward. Now, Dave Ward has said in a letter to the FIA Ethics Committee, in order to be eligible to stand in the FIA presidential election in 2013, a candidate must propose a vice president for sport from each of seven regions, including North America. The written commitments of support that John Todt obtained from ASNs and ACNs prior to the beginning of the election leaves only one club in the North American region that's not formally committed. That's El Salvador. The absurd situation in just one club in North America may determine whether or not there can be a challenger to John Todt risks turning the FIA election into, and this is Dave Ward's word, a farce. So he's saying he wants the support letters to be recognised as a breach of the rules.
You can kind of see that Mosley might have wanted to do all these Machiavellian things because he loved being president of the FIA and he loved all this stuff. I never got the impression John Todt really cares very much. He doesn't very much. Desperate to do it again?
He's done absolutely nothing.
I'm desperate to do SFA for another 4 years. I believe.
Don't forget, it's not a paid post. Remember, we said this.
Ever since I was a small boy, I've wanted to do nothing in the FIA.
I do find it all a bit strange. The election is later on in the year, obviously. We will, as ever, we will try and get them on. We did get Ari Vatanen on the show. Let's see if we can get the challenger on, shall we?
Let's see if we can get John Todt on.
That would be great to have. I have interviewed John Todt.
So have I. Many times.
On American
tack turn.
Tacky turn.
Tacky turn. Ferrari days.
Yes, absolutely. And just finally on this, we do have a Concorde agreement, of course.
Yes.
That kind of slipped out without anybody noticing.
They've actually given the FIA some sort of money for they actually deserve rather than the dodgy deal with them on Max 10 years ago for £10 million forever. Mm. It's 170 or 130 million they've got, I can't remember, it's dollars or pounds, and
right.
Which they'll spend on jets for people to go and get things signed up.
Stop. That's not true. It has been rather a difficult birth, though, hasn't it? And why are people holding out? Why were people holding out? There was one or two of the
teams. Well, what happened was it didn't start in the best of cases because some of the things that people knew happened but didn't have written down happened, found out that they did happen. So suddenly people found out that Ferrari get a shed load more cash and they get more voting power than anyone else. And then they found out that McLaren get a bit more than that. And they found out that Red Bull have got a load as well from nowhere, from being a new team. Then they found out that Marussia going to get nothing. And suddenly everyone kind of went, hang on, that's not fair. And then it all got rolled in and everything else. And they got caught in the politics of day-to-day. They got caught in the politics of Bernie, the politics of Pirelli, and then the politics of the FIA. So basically you had... And it's all turkeys waiting for Christmas anyway.
Just a final note on Formula One. Who this week agrees with you about 2014?
I've read this. Alan Prost.
Not Alan Prost, no.
No, is it? Who is it?
Well, I don't think you'd be very happy about who it is, actually, because it's McLaren Sporting Director Sam Michael who says no one will dominate next year. If we hadn't made changes, what you'd be doing is taking an extremely well-known product and chipping away at marginal gains. That's all gone out of the window. You'll be in one of two positions. You'll either push it too hard and be unreliable, or you'll be too heavy and want to take weight out. It's pretty unlikely you'll get it bang on, and I do think it will mix things up. It's something you're just going to have to cope with. Unreliability he's talking about. There's no secret, getting reliability takes time and ongoing dissection of what we've known. So, more excitement for next year then?
Certainly for the first five races when it sort themselves out, but I think that whenever there's been major rule changes before, someone's got it better than someone else.
Well, yeah, that's almost...
No, I mean by a big chunk.
In fairness, Prost has said 2014 will have engine reliability problems. Even if we see it only in private testing in the winter, but nobody knows at the moment. He said it'll be like we had at the in the turbo era.
No, it won't.
I don't think it'll be that bad.
No, and also, I'll tell you something, nothing.
When the Renault was called a kettle, it blew up that many times.
The up and downy bits will be absolutely fine.
How do you mean the up and downy bits?
The actual V6 turbos will be absolutely fine.
Ah.
It's everything else that's hung off and that the issues are going to come. With your KERS and the various regenerative energies and the delivery of all that. That's where they, you know, even now they have problems keeping 80 horsepower together for a race.
True.
For 6 seconds a lap. To keep 160 horsepower together for 24 seconds a lap, that ain't going to happen.
The other thing is that if anybody can't get KERS to work on a regular basis, it will be a bigger disadvantage. And Newey and Red Bull have not consistently been able to get it to work.
Luckily, they have a vast amount of money to throw at it.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
They're not sure. The little team that can... Actually, we've got, well, quite interestingly, there was a picture on Facebook from a friend of mine who lobbed a picture of 1997 when the Stewart team, who are, of course, Red Bull, started. And they were a little team that could then. There were about 90 of them.
Yeah.
In two industrial units in Milton Keynes.
Yep.
So, well done, Red Bull, for the last 16 years of being fantastic. And I know I have said some things which are not totally favourable to Red Bull. I am very much in awe of their ability to keep producing fantastic machines and fantastic cars.
The only thing you have is that whole, you know, trying to play it like they are the kids round the corner.
They've done better than anyone else in the last 4 years.
But they've spent more money than anybody probably than Ferrari.
They've spent more money than the Ferrari, but they have done a very, very good job. I mean, but the honour is going to the wrong people.
Yeah, well, that's often the case, isn't it? Nick Damon, thank you very much indeed. It is one in, one out, although the next one that we have in will be on the line, and some idea perhaps of some presents for yourself as a motorsport fan or someone that you know, as we welcome to the show a former colleague of mine, actually, on a previous iteration of this show, Andy Holbury, best known, I'm sure, for his writing. And we are talking about a book, Andy, and a book about Dario Franchitti. How has this all come about?
It's something that I've wanted to do for ages. I've been pestering him for a long time to do a book because... You know, just because of his career alone, I think he's worthy of a book. He is extremely reluctant to do an autobiography, so I started rattling my brain to see, well, what could we do? And I came up with an idea. He loves his history of the racing side of things and rallying and MotoGP and all the rest of it. And I said, what if we put a book together of your heroes? And he said, yeah, maybe, in the way that he does. I basically then started doing the emotional blackmail thing of sending him some great photos of Jim Clark and Fangio and just saying, imagine a book with your words and this picture. And it, that basically it started from there. And that's what the book is. It's a collection of his heroes, legends and friends that have all been part of his career, whether it's reading about them, learning about them or racing against them. And it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating.
I can only imagine that putting this together with Dario, who is, as you've rightly noted, a tremendous student of the sport, as my co-commentator Jeremy Shaw would say, and good luck to him for that, actually. I do think it adds both he and his brother Marino, it adds a whole extra dimension to them as individuals and as sportsmen. The hardest thing must have been deciding not what to put in, but what to leave out.
It is. I started off with a list of about 150 drivers that I thought would be relevant in some ways. He crossed a couple out. I won't name them, but there were a couple that didn't make it because he didn't like them. then we went from there. And by the time we'd rattled that down, I'd started getting involved with photographers who, I must say, have been absolutely brilliant on all of this. I've used the best guys in the world, the Paul-Henri Caillé, his archive, which is, you could spend hours and hours and hours looking through. LAT, obviously, the Sutton Photographic, Getty Images got involved, which I wasn't expecting. Really good individual snappers as well. And they've all supplied their best pictures or their favourite shots of so-and-so. And then we ended up with 210 people. And every personality has got a spread. There's a full-page picture, very simple. And then there's Dario's essay to go with the picture. And sometimes it describes the picture, and sometimes it just talks about the guy who's in it. It works really well. And the longer we got on with it, the more involved he got and the bigger it got.
That was the question I was going to ask, because so many of these things, and again, I won't name any names, but you and I, and I'm sure all of our listeners, will have seen books that have had various personalities, drivers, names attached to them. You know, Dave Miggins' big book of cars that I have driven and loved, all of those kind of things. And the title promises much, and then when you get into it, you realise that whilst there has been some input by the named person, it's been negligible, and you don't hear from the words, particularly if you know the people, and we're in the fortunate position of knowing most of the people who bring these books out. If you know the people, it doesn't appear to be their voice, if I can use a term like that. How important for you and for Dario was it that that wasn't the case here, and that the words that were used were Dario's words and his input?
Well, I mean, strangely enough, that was how I approached it. I was going to originally ghostwrite it and then get him to read it and okay it or say yes or no. And I did about three chapters, and I can't remember who it was. It was one particular chapter, and I sent it to him, and he wrote straight back and said, when did you do the interview with me for this? And I said, we've never talked about this. He said, that's exactly how I would have said it. And I would have sworn in that place, and I would have said that. And my God, you know, and that's when I knew that we were onto something. Also, that he cared an awful lot about how he's perceived in the book. There are people who are going to be upset they've been left out. And there's a few people I'm surprised are left out. It's a good collection, and it has got a lot of interest from, I mean, I went to the Belgian Grand Prix, and they all knew about it. And they wanted to know if they were in it, or am I in it, or is so-and-so in it? Well, borrow the book and find out.
Effectively, what we're talking about here is a collection of anecdotes, reminiscences, or just Dario's own thoughts on, as you say, over 200 people in motorsport, all forms of motorsport, which is why it's particularly of interest to Midweek Motorsport. If it has wheels and the keep score, we'll talk about it. And yes, I know Dario is very much like that as well. So great, you've come up with this idea, Andy, and you take it to a publisher, and they clearly jump all over it, give you a large advance, and say, get cracking.
You'd think, wouldn't you? No, that didn't happen at all. I approached five or six of the mainstream publishers, all of whom were only interested in an autobiography, and anything else just wasn't going to sell, wasn't worth looking at. You can't hang a book off of a load of collections of people's drivers, because so-and-so might sell 10 copies or he might sell 3,000. I couldn't feel any of them see the fact that Dario Franchitti is a personality, and that's something that he's doesn't happen for him in the UK, even though he's a UK driver, because he races in America.
Yeah.
Primarily, he sort of is lost about that. I mean, people in the sport know him, know of him, but they don't really know the depth of him. And even I was staggered. I mean, there was quite a lot of things that he came out with, and I thought, I'd better check that fact. That doesn't seem right. And sure enough, it was, you know.
But that's his attention to detail, and in some ways, that's why it almost had to be done this way. Quite clearly, you've got the book put together. You can't find anyone to back it and put it into production. So, disaster and presumably frustration and not a little amount of annoyance as well from both you and Dario.
Well, myself in particular, because I'd put an awful lot of effort into sweet-talking photographers to give me material to, you know, look at publishing, and suddenly I had no product. And it was one of the photographers... a guy called Tony DeZeno in America. He recommended this website called Kickstarter. What happens is we post the idea onto Kickstarter, and then through word of mouth, you know, myself and Twitter and Facebook and Dario's connections and so on, we got people talking about the book, and then we created a video where Dario explained why the book was happening, how much fun it was, and if you want to pledge for it to happen, go to the website.
It's an unconventional but not unique way of doing it. We've spoken to photographer Laura Plattman about her Women in Motorsport book, which is running on very much the same kind of lines. How did you feel putting it out there? Because it's quite public, and it's in some ways it's there to be shot down, isn't it?
Personally, I was pretty wary about doing it.
I'm sure.
I felt that we'd gone so far, and it was such a good idea that it would be wasted. You know, I could have broken it down and sold it as individual features around the world. But it's a book, you know, very simple. It's a collection of his essays and some brilliant photography. And it's a package. And that's what we did. And we had 60 days to raise the money on the Kickstarter. And after 10 days, it was looking good. Then it went a bit shaky. And then it sort of trickled and trickled. But the other beauty of Kickstarter is you can have incentives and rewards. And we've got four separate editions of the book, which range from the basic book, as you would buy in the shelves, and eventually, hopefully, will be in the shelves, right the way through to signed editions, to special covers, to so on. So, and then we also threw in trips to Canassi, and various other things like that, just to help to keep the momentum going. And we reached the target 10 days early.
Is this then the future for slightly more niche publishing going forward, that is effectively publishing by almost public patronage?
Yes, I agree with you completely. I mean, like I said, I was wary about doing it because of, like you, I'm from traditional print. The publisher and the big number that you aim at, and you reach it, and everybody's laughing. This is, seemed to me to be going at it backwards. You know, you had the product, and you had to then go and say, "Right, come on, we need the money for it," which just didn't work in my mind. But it has done, and I'm delighted actually that it's worked the way it has.
I think if you spoke to the responsible adult, if you spoke to Eve, I think she would recognise that business model about us having a product and then trying to get it financed. So it's not a million miles away from some of the things that we even continue to do right now. I think it's a fascinating development, made more so by the fact that although clearly the temptation would have been there to take more traditional advertising, this book does not have that. It is a high quality. I've seen it. I've felt it. It's unbelievable. Much more than just a coffee table book, a book that you would want to get hold of to feel. It's very tactile. And in that side of things, again, you made a rod for your own back there, Andy, both you and Dario, but you went for something that was of the very, very highest quality.
And that's actually my input. I mean, Dario, I think he trusted me with all the print stuff because that's my background. And I said, you know, I've worked on Racer Magazine and Autosport. Both have got very high values, production values. And, you know, I've worked on various books of Formula One teams and publications. And it had to be that standard for me just to be excited by it. And that's my challenge, is to do that. And that's what we've done. I didn't stint on the photography, the paper, the way it's the binding of the book. That's all as best as I could get.
All right, so clearly there are some very, very limited editions of the book that have gone to the patrons, who've gone to the supporters. Does it stop?
No, it has a life afterwards. the plan at the moment is the offer finished on Monday night. So by that time, we know exactly how much we've got to play with, number of copies we need to print and everything, you know, with the orders. And then what happens is they'll be fulfilled, and certainly in time for Christmas. We should have a run on long enough for big enough to start taking more orders just of the basic book itself. So the signed edition or the name on the cover edition, that won't be available, but the general book will be available.
And how, if any one of our listeners now thinks, I want to get a hand on a copy or a couple of copies for me and my friends, how do they do that?
The best place at the moment, and it's in a sort of in-between stage, because we're trying to do some Amazon deal.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good.
In the short run, if they go to www.romanceofracing.com,
which is the title of the book, which we should have mentioned before now. You see, I'll never make it on the on Radio 4's literary programme.
If you register on there just with your email address, we'll let you know as soon as it is available.
Just as a final thought, Andy, and congratulations on getting this one done. Labour of love, yes. Tearing hair out, I'm sure. Some disappointment along the way. However, you now have discovered a new way to do your business, and let's be brutally honest about it. You are a professional writer and have been ever since I've known you. Has this opened up a new door as far as you can see, and does it then excite you about the potential projects that you can do, almost cutting out, in fact actually cutting out, the traditional methods of finding a publisher to back a project?
Absolutely. My mind is racing with, as I would call them, the crazy ideas that turn into good books. There are plenty going on in my head at the minute. You know, whereas before I felt, oh, nobody's going to take that, or how can I get this done? Now I know I can do it. And, Darrow's a great subject to start with because he got so involved, and I really did sort of, you know, drive it as much as I did, really. But together we put something that we're both very proud of, and I'm sure people will be entertained by it and pick it up and put it down and pick it up again and put it on the shelf and look at it again. So, but yes, I've got some more, as I say, crazy ideas.
I love the whole idea, and in some respect, of course, with our listeners and indeed with me, you're preaching to the choir. Many, many years ago, we coined the phrase narrow casting instead of broadcasting, highly targeted radio and now TV that you can do because of new technology. I think this is exciting because nothing for me can replace the excitement and the smell and the touch and the feel of opening a brand new publication, a brand new book, whether it's a magazine that drops through the doors every week. And there are certain things that I still think you can only do in a book. Maybe I am traditional, and maybe there's people out there saying, no, hand off, you're wrong, it can all be reproduced digitally.
I'll just add to that, there is nothing electronically that shows you the images on the screen. They look great. When you see them printed, it's a whole new level.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that.
That's all it needs.
It is called The Romance of Racing, www.romanceofracing.com, if you want to get involved with that. Andrew, congratulations, and thanks for joining us this evening.
That's my pleasure, John. Thank you very much.
Radio Le Mans, where the motorsport just keeps coming.
Better turn my mic up before I try and start talking. Always a good one. We are cracking on a pace tonight. Hello there, it's John Hindorf and a cast of thousands, it would seem, on a rather different looking and sounding midweek motorsport. Hope you're enjoying it so far. We'll be back to a normal show. Well, I say a normal show. What is normality on this show anyway? Back to something more like normality next week, with Tim back at the controls and a bit more of Nick and our regular contributors. But still plenty for you in the second hour of tonight's show, which I'm tentatively calling Here on the Former Colonies, with Richard Creel joining us for a look at all things Antipodean in the second half of the programme tonight, as they build up in Australia to the great race, the Bathurst 1000. Before all that, our regular dose of Americana. Marshall Pruitt from Racer.com is next.
All the news from across the pond. If it happens over there, hear about it here.
Midweek Motorsport.
It is Series 8, Episode 36. John Hindorf playing DJ this week in relative control of the desk and welcoming another guest. Delighted to say good evening or good afternoon, as it will be for him, on the left-hand coast of America, Marshall Prout of Racer.com. MP, how you doing, man?
Wonderful, mate. How about you?
I love this time of year and hate it in equal measure. Everything's happening. It's so busy. We're cleaning out one season and getting to the end of the denouement, and we're already looking forward to the next. The gap between seasons seems to have pretty much disappeared. Let's rattle through what we've got with you. Very, very busy show tonight. We've got to start with the Blue Oval and Ford. Not massively surprising news, but confirmation of what we were kind of expecting.
Absolutely. So we will have the EcoBoost V6 twin turbo that is production-based, making its race debut in the Tusk series come January with Michael Schenck Racing. For those who know their arcane P2 engine references, this is the same engine that Libra used and developed with the Roush Yates folks, and had a very limited, very brief shelf life. Ford then essentially took it out of the P2 realm and said, okay, we're going to make this into a Daytona prototype motor. So very long story short, we will have our first turbocharged, forced induction Daytona prototype engine come next year, which is good news for a series that was built upon big blaring V8s.
And this, of course, is in the Tusk series. Had to get that in tonight, even with Tim not around. A bit of a different bodywork treatment to the venerable DP, and we should stress, a lot of people thought this might have been an LMP announcement. It's not. It's very much a Daytona prototype, which will be the prototype category in Tusk next year. A bit of a different treatment, but haven't we seen this somewhere before? It looks familiar to me.
Yeah, if anyone happened to see the photos that came out from the Roar Before the 24 in January, where the car was wheeled out and shown, it looks very similar. It's essentially the Riley third generation bodywork with slight changes. We have mild inference of the Aston Martin grille up front. Also, with this being turbocharged and it having intercoolers, they've had to work massive NACA ducts into the side pod areas, especially top of the doors. So if you saw it beginning of the year, it frankly doesn't look much different than it does in quote Ford trim compared to stock Riley trim. But yeah, it doesn't look bad. And hopefully, another thing I'll mention quickly, Hindy, is that they will hopefully, by the time we see the car run during its speed test on October 9th, it could look a little bit different, knowing that they've had to reconfigure things a little bit, or will have to reconfigure things, owing to the tunnels coming for the car, which requires moving the exhaust up, turbos up, and in theory moving the intercoolers up. So don't know if we're going to see that for this test, or if that will be when we start getting towards proper Daytona 24-hour testing. But that change is coming. Could be a change to the bodywork.
They are going to go for a speed record at Daytona, though, which interesting way to debut the car.
Yeah, well, yes, interesting is a great way of putting it.
I'm being kind. So
they are going after the, and I apologize, I think it's 1986, 87, track record at Daytona. This is the oval, mind you. We're not talking the road course. We're talking going after the big oval track record held by Awesome Bill from Dawsonville, Georgia, who did this in a Ford Thunderbird. Lap record of 210.3 miles per hour, which is 19,000 kilometers per hour. So they're going to do this in a turbocharged Daytona prototype. I can only assume that they will be winding up the Eco Boost, so it is, you know, going semi-nuclear.
More boost than Eco, presumably, at that point.
The eco part is just going to be straight boost. And as for the Continental tires, we will also find out if they are up to the task of corner loads above 210.3 miles an hour. Ooh. Colin Brown as well will be doing the test driving. So all I can say is strap in and hold on, young man. We will be praying for you.
Oh, yes, we will. I can't wait for that. I'm sure it'll be on a stream somewhere. This time of the year, we often talk about free agency, more usually in American stick and ball sports, but that is exactly what is the big buzz this weekend going into the IndyCar weekend. Why is that?
Funny, Heidi. We've had a very rich free agent silly season, I don't know what you want to call it, derby per se. We have our current Indy 500 winner, Tony Kanaan, who we've know has been speaking with multiple teams, that has been narrowed down and is expected to be a signing and possible announcement this weekend that he will be the new fourth driver at Chip Ganassi Racing. So that is essentially done and dusted. Interesting development on another front, and this is maybe getting into a little bit of the behind-the-scenes bit, and I admittedly can't go all the way into it, but the KV Racing team had been working their behinds off to keep Tony. He is, without a doubt, the most popular IndyCar driver there is, period.
Good for sponsors.
And absolutely. Plus the reigning Indy 500 winner, plus a past series champion. So you take all of those things from a team standpoint, a marketing standpoint, it's pure gold. Without it, and this is a kind of a mid-level team, one that, you know, is trying to reach the upper echelon but isn't quite there, having a Tony Kanaan is vital for their continued existence. So understandably, they've been working incredibly hard to keep him. Although that appears to have fallen through, the very real concerns of what would their future be like without a Tony, without a big marketable driver to sell sponsors on, that frankly became the follow-up to the Kanaan to Ganassi story. And with that said, it sounds like, and by saying sounds like, that's also a way of me saying I know, but it sounds like there could be a great solution to come through this in that James Hinchcliffe, Mr. GoDaddy, Mr. three-time IndyCar winner this year, Mr. Andretti Autosport driver, was informed that GoDaddy will not be returning for 2014. That had been the hope. Will they return? And if so, how much money will they return with? And is it enough to keep Hinch? Because running a car isn't cheap. It's not that his salary is massive, but it's not cheap to run an Indy car. And people no longer just put a car on track and come out of their own pocket among the team owners for the most part. So with all that said, you had, frankly, a big void at KV with TK moving to Ganassi and the team needing to find somebody to dazzle and hold on to the sponsors they'd sold on Kanaan. And it looks like young Mr. Hinchcliffe is that man. So he is that bright, young, popular star that it could appease them. So with all that being said, Heidi, it's also known that Andretti Autosport is trying to put together an offer to keep him. They think they might have a sponsor. So between Andretti, between KV, one of the two should happen. My two cents, I think it's going to end up being KV. And then on a very quick and brief final note, we'll mention that Ryan Briscoe, who has filled in more than capably at Panther Racing this year and really just thrilled the team with his energy and enthusiasm, he could be announced. Well, we're not sure when the announcement will come. The team has said possibly end of the season or at the end of the season, but it's believed he has also inked a contract.
Good for him.
So three big free agents in IndyCar, in theory all three of them, after months of speculation, could end up signing their deals within the same week. Whether they're all announced in the same week, I can't say, but some good business being done there for some folks we all care a lot about.
Houston this weekend, and we could have the title all set up and done.
We could. How crazy is that? We have Elio Castroneves with a 49-point lead over Scott Dixon. Dixie's heading to a track that is aerial. I mean, it is a rally. It's a rally cross stage on the streets of Houston. So that is what Dixie lives for. There's I believe 54 points available during each round. We have a doubleheader this weekend. 108 points on offer. Could Dixie draw down Elio's lead? If not, take the lead. Yes. Could Elio, by shadowing Dixon and also Simon Pagenaud, who's third in points, could Elio, by shadowing those guys at both events and finishing very close to them, put the title beyond reach heading into Fontana, the season finale on the Oval? That's also very possible. So yeah, it's very true. If Elio can win this weekend and keep the two behind him, he could absolutely absolutely wrap up the championship this weekend, which for him, I'll mention, this event is sponsored by Shell and Pennzoil. Mm. This weekend, he is driving the Shell car. So if we're looking for great synergy, there's nothing he would love to do more than win his first IndyCar championship in 16 seasons on home soil in front of his sponsors, on his sponsor's home soil and in their colors.
Yeah, that would be pretty good. MP, sorry for the short one this week. Marshall Pruitt from racer.com. You're listening to Midweek Motorsport. John Hindorf with a plethora of guests this week, and we rattle on with our ear on the former colonies as by the magic of technology. If I push this button over here, we should be able to say hello to our Antipodean correspondent, my co-commentator from the Liqui Moly 12 Hours earlier this year, Richard Crail.
It's great, isn't it? Neither of us got jet lag to do it either, so it works well.
No, exactly right, exactly right. And how do we find you? You're getting revved up for what traditionally, of course, in the V8 Supercars season is a big month. We have the big race, the great race, and then we're back at the Gold Coast as well. We'll talk about that in a little while. But Bathurst coming round, is this the time of the year, like, you know, coming up to the Cup Final or the British Grand Prix or the Super Bowl? Is the atmosphere and the anticipation beginning to ramp up for the big one?
Yeah, it is. This is a great time to be in Australia, to be honest. And you know how sports mad we are down here, John. And last weekend we had the AFL Grand Final, the local football league Grand Final, and the National Rugby League Grand Final, which is probably the second biggest sporting event in Australia after the AFL one, is this weekend coming. And then the week after that is the Bathurst 1000, 2 weeks later on the Gold Coast, for a massive event with a lot of history. So great time to be in Australia, and great time to be a fan of V8s, because there's probably more intrigue and more questions being asked, I think, about this Bathurst 1000 that we've seen in a couple of years. And the introduction of new manufacturers this year with the Erebus Mercedes and the Nissan Altima coming into the sport has just got a level up. And we were at Sandown 3 weeks ago, John, for the Sandown 500, and biggest crowd I've ever seen there for probably 4 or 5 years. So much interest. There was a lot of feuding going on during that race, a lot of controversy. So it's an exciting time to be a fan of motorsport in Australia, and this Bathurst is going to be one of the most opening 10 years, I reckon.
I love the fact that what we have here is a fantastic regional championship. It's not fair just to call it a national championship, although many people would say it is, but a regional championship, because it takes over the public psyche. Within that, you've got the longer races where guys are teaming up two to a car, and then you've got Bathurst. It's been a good season of racing. Two new manufacturers that you mentioned. We saw Erebus, of course, at the Liqui Moly 12 Hours, starting off in great form on the mountain there with the Mercedes-Benz. Nissan have taken a win this year. Now, you know, albeit they've had a little bit of help from balance of performance, but I think that would have been a surprise to quite a few people.
Yeah, that was a remarkable weekend, and I don't think anyone expected, let alone the Nissan team, that they'd be winning in their first season back. And for those that don't follow V8 Supercars quickly, I'll summarise the dramas, because they've just rolled on. It's actually been great for the sport, because it's got people talking. But the Nissans at the Winton round 2 months ago were allowed to run a different blend of ethanol fuel compared to the regular cars, because their fuel economy is not as good as the established brands, the Ford and Holden brands, in the championship. So with a view to enduro races at Winton, two of the Nissans and one of the Erebus Mercs were allowed to run an E70 blend of ethanol to try and help their endurance when it came to the long-distance races. It just so happened they did that to the Nissans at the track they were always going to go well at, tight and twisty Winton, where their chassis works very, very well. So in a weird and kind of unfortunate set of circumstances, the Nissans won. They finished 1-2 in the Saturday race, James Moffat beating home Michael Caruso. And the show went up in arms that they were running a special blend of fuel just to get Nissan to the front, to give them a win as a PR stunt. But it was a sport decision. All the teams signed off on it, and it's rumbled on since then. But the four-valve engines that the Nissans and the Mercs run just use more fuel than the pushrod engines in the Ford and Holden. So that was the problem. They've since gone a different way to fix the parity for the endurance races. So they're going to a mandatory number of pit stops rather than a different blend of fuel. It kind of worked at Sandown. Lee Holdsworth and Craig Baird finished fourth in the Mercedes, but they're still spending between 15 and 25 seconds longer in pit lane,
yeah,
regardless, over the course of an endurance race. And as you know well, my friend, you can't afford to do that if you're going to win an endurance race at Sandown, Bathurst, or anywhere in the world.
Well, and the other thing is, I do feel, if I'm honest, for the regulatory bodies, because trying to get the balance between two very different technologies, I never thought, if I'm honest, that the chassis would be the issue, because the guys who are looking after the cars have plenty of experience, but building the engines, and particularly building engines of a very different type, against the Holden and Ford teams, who have, you know, since Noah was a lad, got that experience behind them, that was always going to be the issue. And the parity issue, I think, will rumble on, and it's a headache. It will continue to be a headache, because what you're talking about is two very different technologies. And we've seen in all of endurance racing, whether it's prototypes or GT racing at Le Mans or in ACO racing, if you are trying to find parity all the time, you're going to come up short, because there will be times when one car is better than another. And the variety is what we love about motor racing. It's been a very good season for Holden Commodores. 9 of the top 11 point scorers are Holden Commodores, with Will Davidson and Mark Winterbottom, Frosty, sitting in third and fourth position, and still with half a chance, mathematically at least, of challenging the two Red Bull Racing Australia cards of Jamie Wincup and Craig Lowndes, the number one and 888 car, separated by just 96 points, those two, and with a point further back, it's Will Davidson. Who's got the momentum going in? It would be easy, just for me as I am, looking at the table, to say, well, you've got to think that Holden's are going to come out on top, but what have the Ford teams, and possibly even some of the newer teams, got in these endurance races, and particularly at the mountain?
Look, Red Bull 888 are an unbelievable team, and what we've seen as this season has gone on, first year of the new car of the future regs, mm-hmm. they've got better and better, and the cream, as they say, always rises to the top, and that's happened. They finished 1-2 at Sandown. Jamie Wincup was utterly dominant there. At times he was 7 or 8 tenths a second a lap quicker than anybody else, even his teammate Craig Lowndes, and that's just a different ballpark in a parity mm-hmm. formula. But they just get a feeling that Ford's preparing something for Bathurst. They, Ford Performance Racing, are the frustration, it's got to be said, of the media centre in the V8 supercar land. They give us great fodder, but they just find unique and exciting ways to lose big races. And they've done it over the course of their history, and it's extremely frustrating for the large legion of Ford fans that are copping a bit of a hammering at the moment, because they don't have many cars on the grid anymore, and Ford Australia's in a world of pain. And
yes,
Davison and Winterbottom had a pit stop drama at Sandown at the 500. There was controversy. There was multi-21 was thrown around in the press conference as a reference as well between the two, and who was going to pit first, and slower cars should have got out the way. Just remarkable issues that team needs to iron out. But they've got massive car speed, and they've got two of the best drivers in the business in Will Davison and Frosty Winterbottom, as you said. So they're looking pretty good. Mount Panorama, though, is a place where great drivers in not quite as great machinery always tend to shine. So when it comes to October, you have to look to Garth Tander in the Holden Racing Team car. HRT have had something of a return to form this season. They've got a couple of victories with Garth Tander, and James Courtney won at Winton, his first victory since he won the championship in 2010. So they're back in form. They're looking good. And the Brett Jones Racing Team, Fabian Coulthard's had 3 race wins this season. Jason Bright's had a couple. They've looked very, very strong. And they always bring their A-game when it gets to Mount Panorama. But this is the great thing. You can run through this list of contenders and pick out driving combinations that are great. Scott McLaughlin, the Kiwi rookie sensation, who's just the breath of fresh air that the sport down here has been looking for. He's teamed up with Jack Perkins. He's already got almost 10 Bathurst 1000 starts to his credit, despite only being 27, so son of the legendary Larry. That's an unbelievable combination with Gary Rogers Motorsport. Always go well on the mountain.
And this is one thing we should point out. They don't pair the two top drivers together, so it's not Jamie and Craig Lowndes together. Jamie's paired up with Paul Jumbrell. Warren Luff will be in with Lowndesy. by no means are those guys rabbits, quite clearly, but it throws up some really interesting combinations. Lee Holdsworth and Craig Baird, of course, in the Irwin race and Mercedes-Benz. It still draws, these endurance races still draw some names that some of our listeners will recognise. Ryan Briscoe in with Russell Ingall in the Super Cheap Auto yep. Racing Holden.
Ryan at Sandown actually led his first ever V8 supercar laps, and he's been in and out of V8s for probably 7 or 8 years now, I think. But he yes. actually led laps at Sandown and came out and jumped out of the car and had the biggest smile on his face, as he always does. But he finally ticked that box and got some V8 supercar laps later. He was over the moon for that. But great driver. And as you said, you know, Greg Murphy driving with James Courtney. Murph out of a full-time drive, four-time Bathurst champion, the fastest guy ever to lap that joint in a V8 with that amazing qualifying lap in 03. Like with James Courtney, who's back in form in a HRT Commodore. That's an unbelievable combination. Yes. And that's what these enduros bring in, with the primary driver having to stay in their own car and good co-drivers needing to be found.
And I like that rule. And it throws up things like in the Techno Autosports Holden, Jonathan Webb, with Mark Lieb. Now, Mark Lieb, yeah. to us, Porsche factory driver. He's got, you know, cut him in half, and he's got the Porsche crest inside.
It's great, isn't it? And Techno Autosport have gone a different route to a lot of the teams, where they've got drivers who race in the second tier V8 development series or in local categories. Porsche Carrera Cup, a lot of guys have come out of that. Craig Baird for one of them, Stephen Richards another. But they've gone that international route because they liked what they saw on the Gold Coast last year. And driving with Shane Van Gisbergen is Jeroen Blikkemolen. Jeroen's produced one of the best stints I've ever seen at Mount Panorama in the 12-hour, not of this year, of last year, when he was driving one of the Erebus Black Falcon Mercedes. He was in the rain, had the traction control turned off, and was absolutely flying. And it's one of the better stints I've ever seen. So it's an interesting way that Techno's gone, but they've got to be contenders. And Blikkemolen's been there a couple of times now. He knows which way the track goes, and we all know how capable he and Mark Lebar are as drivers.
Is it possible to say that form going into the great race at Bathurst stands for anything? Or is it such a different event? And we should mention as well, for those that don't know, that it doesn't matter how experienced you are, there is a frisson of excitement and goosebumps from every driver up and down there, because as much as they say, it's not just another championship race, is it?
No, it's not. And for those that don't know, Bathurst is known as the grand final in our sport, despite it now not being the final round of the year by far. We've raced well into December this year, but it always used to be that climactic finale of the Australian touring car season. And it's the most special race in the year. It's the most iconic race. It's the race all the drivers and teams look forward to going to. But for those of us on the other side of the fence that only get to drive the place at 60 k's an hour instead of 300 k's an hour down Conrad Straight, or even more impressively, 220 across the top, we all sit there and we go, look, this is the event. This is the thing we want to be at. And that's why it gets the biggest media contingent of the season and the most photographers lining the circuit and an amazing number of fans. 45,000 people camp there from Thursday through to Sunday night or Monday morning. And it's just one of those events that it doesn't matter how many times you go to Mount Panorama, you drive over the hill on Panorama Drive out of Bathurst, and the hair on the back of your neck stands up when you see that white writing on the side of the mountain. And you do your traditional first lap at slow speeds, and you stand at the top at Brock Skyline, and you look out over the town, and you can see Conrad Straight a kilometre and a half away down in the distance and 400-odd metres below you, and you just go, I cannot believe they have a car race here, and I can't believe I'm here to see it again. It's just one of those great events.
Now, let's remind everybody, that is Australian time, Thursday, October the 10th, and the race itself on Sunday, October the 13th, and well worth staying up for. Practices through Thursday, Friday and Saturday. The top 10 shootout is on Saturday, 5 o'clock Australian time. Warm up at 7:25, and the race starts at 10:30 on Sunday morning. There are ways to see it legally on the web. I'm not sure that there's any live TV coverage, sadly, back here in Europe, but go on to the v8supercars.com.au site and you'll be able to see all of the ways that you can watch it on there. I'm going to put you on the spot here, Crailsy. I'll let you have three choices. I'll give you three each way bets, you know. If you had to pick
All right. And I'll do this on the condition that you give listeners a bit of feedback on a very special combination I want to talk to you about very shortly. I've picked already who I think will win the race, and I think it'll be Craig Lowndes and Warren Luff. Mm-hmm. Craig Lowndes is the king of the mountain, take two, after the late, great Peter Brock, who was his mentor and idol and worked with him in his early days. Craig continues to produce the most incredible drives at Mount Panorama, and he goes to an extra level there, and he's one of the few drivers in the field that will openly say that I would rather win Bathurst than win the championship. So Craig,
good for him.
He goes to another level at that place, and Warren Luff is an excellent co-driver. And I, despite what happened at Sandown, I think they will be the better of the two Red Bull cars when it gets to Sunday at about 5:30 in the afternoon and we get to 994 kilometres of 1,000 and they start the final lap. My second favourite for the race, and this is from left field, is the combo I mentioned before, the Gary Rogers Motorsport Commodore of Scott McLaughlin and Jack Perkins. Mm-hmm. Jack, I think, one of the better rounded co-drivers. He's got more starts than a majority of the rookie co-drivers in that field, or the non-full-time drivers, it should be said. And Jack's won plenty this year in the Dunlop Series, the second tier V8 series in Australia. And keep in mind, that field has 32 cars this season, and the top 15 at Winton were covered by 5/10 in qualifying. So the development series is not uncompetitive, and Jack's been winning regularly in that, in a Commodore. So that's a great combination, very, very strong. And I think Will Davison and Steve Owen in the number 6 FPR Ford will be there or thereabouts as well. Will was driving very well. Steve Owen, again, winning races in the development series, the second tier series. I like them. And if FPR get their stuff together in pit lane and find ways not to lose the motor race, I reckon they'll be in with a real shot. And I think the number 6 car, on balance, is going to be the better of the two. But it's very, very hard to pick. My favourite's definitely Lowndes and Luff. But outside of that, you just throw some balls in the air and see where they land, and that's how the podium's going to work out. The question I have for you, John Hindoff, is how will the international gurus go in the guest car that 888 are running? Now, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but they're running a third Holden Commodore, and behind the wheel will be the DTM guru, Matthias Ekstrom, and Andy Preo. Now, Andy, the World Touring Car Champion, has been there a couple of times and gone very, very well. Ekstrom's a complete and utter rookie to the mountain, but you know his credentials better than I do as a very, very accomplished racing car driver. Well, how do you think they'll go?
Well, this is interesting, isn't it? Because effectively this is a wild card entry in the Xbox colours. Yep. Nothing wrong with the team. They know how to put the car together.
Yeah.
I'll come to Andy in a moment. As an ex-hill climber, going uphill is never an issue for him. Matthias Ekstrom is an interesting bod. It's easy to look at him and say, ah, yeah, well, you know, he's done that DTM thing. He's been champion in that. Yeah, you can kind of see the similarity between driving a DTM car and driving a V8. It's not the same, but it's lots of power. It's a big car. It's got weight transfer. However, what I would say about Ekstrom has got nothing to do with what I've seen him do in the DTM and everything to do with what I've seen him do in Race of Champions. The boy is tremendously adaptable. 3 titles he's taken, and you know, when he's on form, he can wipe the floor with the world's very best drivers. And we're talking like, you know, Schumacher, Vettel, all these guys, Ekstrom has pounded them into the dirt in the Race of Champions. And you can see, as I'm sure many of our listeners will do, yeah, that's not proper motorsport. Well, they all say that when they get there, and it'll be the same in early December when we head back down to Raman Ganjala Stadium in Bangkok, or just outside Bangkok this year. It'll all be a bit of fun until it's not, and it's not when they start running the stopwatch.
Yeah, exactly.
He is very, very good. He's run in WRC, World Rally Championship. He's had a go at NASCAR. He's done X Games when it was in Munich earlier this year. I think he could be the surprise package. What he will do, because he's a thinking driver, he will listen to the team. He will listen to the experience that's around him. Andy Preo, stick him in a Shopman trolley and he'll race it for you. Started off as many times British Hill Climb champion, supported by a chap that I worked for actually for quite a long time, David Grace, who was the CEO at Rockingham Motor Speedway just I don't know, 15 miles, if that, from where I'm talking to you now. Andy made a massive impact in British touring cars, having never driven a front-wheel drive racing car in his life when he came in, I think, at Ulton Park and won his first race, albeit he had no weight in the car. But even so, that was still quite an achievement. And hasn't he gone on to justify that talent throughout his world touring car career, mostly, of course, with rear-wheel drive, with BMW, a European champion and a couple of world championships under his belt? I have to say, he hasn't sparkled quite as much as I thought he might in DTM, and he had a couple of misfires at Le Mans as well when he went into the longer races, which really surprised me, because I thought his mindset would be perfect for longer races. But I tell you what, that is, keep out of trouble. I'm not saying they're going to win it, because that would be silly, but keep out of trouble, top six, yes. Maybe better, you know, Krilzy.
Yeah, I agree with you. It can be done. International drivers can succeed on the mountain. And I go back to one of my favourite 1000s ever was 2007. It was won by Craig Lowndes, ironically. Amazing race. Like the 12 hour this year, the weather came in the last hour and half a dozen of the top drivers crashed. Lowndes and Stephen Johnson diced for the lead, and it was an unbelievable race. But through it all, and actually it missed 95% of the conversation post-race, was a top five finish in the second 888 car for the late, great Alan Simonson and Richard Lyons. And they just rose to the occasion. They were methodical. They were quiet. They didn't qualify that well, but they're only a second and a bit off the pace in qualifying, which on a 6.2K lap is okay generally in V8 supercars. You can get away with that. And they pounded around and finished fifth. So I've got no doubt these guys can finish in the top six. I don't think that's an overly exciting call, to be honest with you. If they get, and I think with Prio in the car, if he's in the car and we get a safety car, as we always do, with 20 laps to go and there's a fight to the flag and he's somewhere in the top 10, you'd have to say there are factors somewhere for top five, I would have thought. And Andy Prio made his start in the early 2000s, his first start at Bathurst, driving one of the Kmart Racing Commodores, which at the time they were one of the leading teams. It was about the same time Greg Murphy did his unbelievable lap of the gods and was dominating the sport. And he came into Australia with zero recognition factor.
Yeah.
The track announcer didn't know how to pronounce his surname when they announced the driving combinations at 9 o'clock on the Sunday morning. And by the end of the weekend, everyone was going, gee, this guy can drive. Where's he come from? What's his story? What a great find. And we've been looking forward to seeing him back here in Australia, because we all know the racing fans, he knows his capabilities. He's not a household name by far, and I don't know many people here that have seen a World Touring Car Championship race that he's won, but those that follow the sport understand his capabilities. So he's a great get, and an Ekstrom as well. We all know how good he is. It was interesting, though, John, that car, a lot of us, those that look at conspiracy theories, thought that this was the Casey Stoner entry, the MotoGP world champion who's been running in the development series this year. There was a lot of talk around the industry that he was going to be behind the wheel at Mount Panorama to make his Bathurst debut. But I think in the end they decided that perhaps he wasn't quite ready, not quite experienced enough, and will hold fire on that for a little while.
Well, I'm pleased that Andy's gone back there. He always said to me it was just like basically, you know, 45 minutes of hill climbing when he was in the car. He's not frightened of the walls being that close. The big race, don't forget, second weekend in October. Go to v8supercars.com.au. You'll find ways that you can watch it over here in Europe. If you're listening to Midweek Motorsport on a Wednesday night, our normal crew enhanced immeasurably by the dulcet tones of the Antipodes, courtesy of Richard Krills. Krillsy, one of our co-commentators at the Liqui Moly Bathurst 12 hours earlier this year, and some news on that coming up as well. But I want to talk about Casey Stoner. It was the big thing that he was moving into four wheels, and now all of a sudden it appears he may not be staying there. He certainly hasn't set the world on fire in the development series. All kinds of rumours. He's been testing back on MotoGP bikes, although everybody's saying he's not coming back. What are you hearing? And is he still listed as a competitor in the rest of the season?
Our understanding here is that, yes, he'll continue and finish the season that he committed to, and I don't think there's any doubt in that. And that sort of hasn't been brought up in all the conversation around Casey in the second half of this season about what he's doing. Is he going back to MotoGP? Is he going to take a year off completely? It came out in the press before the Sandown weekend, so probably a month ago, and said, I want to do less next year than I am now. And I mean, he's doing a 7-round development series championship, and that's about it. So, look, there's been some questions about his motivation. There's been some questions about his commitment. Maybe he came into VR Supercar Racing expecting to do better than he has. But as I said before, the development series is unbelievably competitive, and he qualified less than a second from pole at Winton and was somewhere buried in the back of the top 20. So it's a tough old game to be competitive in that series, let alone the main game. And it's going to take more than one season for Casey to become competitive. We all know he can drive. We've all seen him drive. He hits every apex, as you'd expect a world champion. Doesn't matter if it's on two or four wheels to do. He gets the power down right. His data's apparently very, very good. He works well with the team. There's no doubt he's capable of doing the job, but I think from what we can tell, it's a motivation factor at the moment for Casey. Does he just want to disappear for a season, have a complete year away from the sport, travel the world with his young family and see the sights, or just spend a year testing MotoGP bikes? I don't know, and until he comes out in the press, I think there's just going to be a lot of speculation. I'm not too sure if he expected to come back and race V8s and get away from all the media exposure and all the PR that he admitted he didn't really like in MotoGP, because it was always going to be a big thing.
Yes.
Because the last guy that came from two wheels to racing V8s was Wayne Gardner, and even back in the early 90s when he made his touring car debut, he was swamped with media, and it's a bigger game now than it was then, arguably. So I'm not too sure if he came in with unrealistic expectations about how his season was going to go, but it's been very, very tough. And yeah, which way he goes is entirely up to him at this stage, and we really don't know what's going to happen. But he's definitely going to complete the season, and I know for a fact he's looking forward to getting to Bathurst and his first look there at a V8 supercar. And who knows? If he gets a good result at Bathurst, that might change how he's thinking, because the world's always a brighter place if you go well at Mount Panorama, and if you get on the podium, he might get a change of mind and go, oh, all of a sudden this isn't so bad after all.
Look, we don't get you on the show very often, so I'm going to make the most of this, and it appears the collective are liking this. It's Series 8, Episode 36 of Midweek Motorsport. Krailsy on the line from the other side of the world. Got to ask you about a couple of races in the V8 Supercar Championship, one that we've had and one that's yet to come. We were at the Circuit of the Americas last weekend for the combined ALMS and FIA World Endurance Championship race. Fantastic facility. Strong rumour that V8 supercars aren't going back there after what was a pretty decent turnout of crowd, a very decent and entertaining and drama-filled set of races there for the 400 earlier in the year. What are you hearing, Krailsy?
Fact, not going back next year, at least, though the new boss of the sport, James Warburton, who's got massive experience in the Australian television industry, came on board midway through this season as some people putting him up in lights as a saviour of the V8s that have been through a rough time behind the scenes of late V8 supercars, and a series of CEOs have gone through. James announced the new calendar recently, and it did not feature Circuit of the Americas, much to the dismay of many of the competitors in the sport who thoroughly enjoyed the trip. But James was about consolidation and balancing out the schedule and where it's at. There were some issues finding a date that worked for both sides of the pond in between the two countries, and I think there was a clashing event on the date that V8 Supercars wanted at Circuit of the Americas. So the contract is ongoing. They had a 5-year deal, and V8s intend to honour that, and the track intends to honour that as well. I think they both see the appeal in V8s being there. V8 certainly see the appeal in going to America for the manufacturers and the sponsors involved in the championship. But they're taking a year off, so they won't go in 2014. But in the release confirming that the 2014 calendar, they said, yep, we're going back in 2015. We'd like to twin it with another international event, preferably in the United States somewhere, to keep those costs down, to consolidate your costs. If you're going to send the cars 14,000 k's across the pond to race in the V8, you may as well do it twice or three times rather than just a one-off. Keeps the costs down for the promoters, and you can have a meaningful series of races and get some momentum in the media and television and branding over there as distinct from just a one-off race. So the intention is to go back, but at this stage, the sport wants to consolidate what they've got in Australia, build their Australian events, and they've put a lot of work into securing events that we all thought were absolutely gone, and getting new deals done for major city-based races in Australia that are so crucial for V8 supercars and the kind of profile that they've got. So short answer is, yep, they'll be back in America, but it looks like it'll be 2015 rather than 2014.
I have a suspicion that the track would like to move the ALMS and the WEC into that sort of part of the earlier part of the year to take them away from the college football season. The Longhorns were at home the weekend of the race this year, and when you get 105,000 people sitting watching college football, that's a big chunk of people that won't be going motor racing, of course. Got to ask you as well, Crailsy, about the Gold Coast race. When we were talking down at Mount Panorama at the Liqui Moly 12 Hours, we thought that race might have been done, and yet, like a phoenix from the ashes, it has been resurrected and rises again.
It's one of the great stories of reinvention, the Gold Coast race. It went from being an IndyCar race for about 8 months. It was an A1GP race right up until a week before the A1GP cars didn't arrive. The V8s filled the breach, and we all thought it was gone. We all thought there was no way in the world that the Queensland government, which is in massive financial strife and quite broke, were going to be able to keep underwriting this event. And we thought it was going to come down to a choice between the two major Queensland events at the Gold Coast and Townsville. And you might wonder, well, two Queensland events. Keep in mind that Townsville is further than the distance between Melbourne and Sydney, north of the Gold Coast. So it's in a different world, and it's a completely different market, and a very, very important one. That regional North Queensland event is huge for the V8s. We thought there'd be a choice between the two. We thought they'd just keep Townsville because that's an important tourism boost for that area. The Gold Coast has got the beaches and the buildings and the very, very attractive ladies and just about everything else. So why do they need a V8 race? But somehow or another, deal of the century, they've extended the contract for 3 years. Both events will be back, as well as the one at Queensland Raceway in Ipswich in Brisbane's western suburb. So great news. Slight change of format, though, John, compared to where it's been. Of course, it's been an international co-driver event for the last couple of seasons, and they've realigned it now just to become a third part of the endurance season. So the same drivers that go to Sandown and then to Bathurst will go on to the Gold Coast. They've inaugurated the Endurance Cup, which is now a series of those three races, big trophy for the winner and surprise money at the end of that, to make it its own little season, the endurance season within a season. So yeah, amazing deal. We all thought it was absolutely dead and gone, but it turns out it's not, and that's good for the sport. It needed it. It's a real glitter event for V8 supercars. It's very, very important for the fan base to see that still on the calendar.
Big turnaround in fortunes of V8 supercars, and I'm pleased to see it. Obviously, you mentioned right at the start of our little chat that Ford aren't in the best of places. Some talk that there won't be another Falcon after this one, although Holden have committed to continuing with the big four-door V8, and worrying times, it seemed, for the V8 Supercar Championship. It seems to be just, I'm not going to say it's taken off like a rocket to Mars, but it's on the upswing, certainly, and I do think that's very important for the whole of Australian motorsport.
Oh, no doubt. It's a barometer for the sport. V8s have got a lot of detractors in Australia, and you know only too well, John, that Aussies often have a bit of a tall poppy syndrome, and if something gets too big for its own boots, we'll be the first ones to tell them and to peg it down a level. And I don't think there's any estimation that V8s probably got a little bit big for where they really were for a while, and their eyes were bigger than their stomach, and I think they expanded too quickly. They tried too hard, and as a result, the sport's financial position suffered. They didn't get a great TV deal during their last negotiations, and that's hurt them in a big way. Just in terms of funding, the actual exposure and the amount of airtime they get is still pretty remarkable for a domestic touring car category. It's still in the top five sports in attendance in Australia. So, look, it's got a great position. For a domestic touring car category, the level of professionalism and the competition involved is remarkable. Four manufacturers now, five next year with Volvo Polestar coming in with Gary Rogers Motorsport, which is hugely exciting. And look, the 28 cars at Sandown covered within 0.8 of a second in qualifying. So It's remarkably competitive. Sometimes we don't see the forest for the trees here, and we look overseas and go, oh, gee, wouldn't it be nice if we had DTM regs, or wouldn't it be nice if we had this or that? And you just got to sit back sometimes and go, well, hang on a minute. Despite the fact we're struggling a little bit, we don't have a dud series here. This is a remarkably strong, competitive, exciting championship that I get a lot of tweets going, gee, I wish the V8s were shown live in the UK. I wish we had some V8 supercars over here or in Europe, and Americans are the same. So, you know, I think there's probably a bit of top-off syndrome going on. I think we just need to take a breath, realise that the sport ebbs and flows, and you have some better years than others in terms of finances and sponsorship and exposure, and we've still got a very, very strong domestic championship here, and that's good for the sport.
What I find remarkable is that in a period around the world where motorsport, like everyone else, for the most part, are pulling their horns in a little bit and being a little bit careful about where they spend their money. In the space of 12 months, you'll have had three new international manufacturers getting into a very, very closed series in a very particular part of the world, which happens to be the VIA Supercars. Now, all right, you could say that Erebus is not Mercedes-Benz. It's an offshoot of. Yes, I accept that. But in terms of Volvo with Polestar, Polestar are their official tuning company. Nissan are absolutely Nissan. And Darren Cox, head of global motorsport for Nissan and Nismo, has turned round and said when they looked at the numbers, it was a no-brainer. So in some respects, Ford and Holden of Australia probably don't realise how good they've had it. Let's move on.
Absolutely.
Let's just move on a little bit. A couple of other big Australian stories, Australian motorsport stories that we've got to ask for your perspective on, Crailsy, because as I say, we don't get you very very often, and thanks for giving up your time for this week's show. Mark Webber, you and I were talking about it at Bathurst this year. We've been following the story since last August, September. We got the nod in April as the cars were about to go green at Silverstone. I remember getting it in my headphones and unable to stop myself saying and blurted out loud, and boy, did we take some stick for that. Mark walks away from Formula One, had a chance to stay, picks sports car racing and Porsche instead. Not a case of him being a washed up driver, not a case of him having nowhere to go. How's that played out in Australia?
It was actually handled pretty well here, and it was obviously some drivers leave Formula One and don't say what they're doing.
Yes.
Mark was very, very clear straight out that, well, I'm leaving F1, I've got to deal with Porsche, I'm going to go race sports cars. So I think everyone breathed a slight sigh of relief going, well, he's not going to be lost to the sport completely. The feeling here, especially amongst the motorsport media, is that Formula One's loss is sports car racing's massive gain. And the outspoken nature that Mark brings to it, his laid-back style, the fact he's generally pretty open, is going to be a great thing for the World Endurance Championship to get. And I think well done to Porsche as well for signing him. He's going to be a great team leader amongst a group of team leaders, I'm sure, that will drive those factory Porsches. You've got to remember, this is a guy that spends his own money on Porsche road cars. So this wasn't just a Porsche, we'll throw a couple of million dollars your way and you can race sports cars until you're ready to retire full time. This is, I want to go and win Le Mans in a car and a brand I'm passionate about. And that's what Mark Webber does. If he didn't want to race sports cars, I couldn't be bothered. He'd retire and walk away and you'd probably never hear from him again. But that's just the way he functions. There's not a great degree of sentimentality, I think, about Mark Webber. But he wants to do this. He's passionate about sports car racing. He's been there before, remember, with Mercedes back in the day, and very, very famous for his exploits aerobatically at Le Mans, shall we say. There was a sense of irony when Bernd Schneider rocked up at the Bathurst 12-hour earlier this year, because they were teammates in the AMG sports cars back in the FIA GT World Championship back in the day. So, look, I think it's a good move. It's been well received here. It's great that he's in the sport. It's been better received because there's a like-for-like replacement in a happy young Aussie in Daniel Ricciardo jumping into that seat. And for the Australian Grand Prix promoters, they're thrilled that they've still got an Aussie presence. And we are too, because it's great for Formula One. So, no, good move. I can't wait to see what he does at Le Mans. And you know better than I do, John, that Porsche don't do things for half.
No.
I work for them here calling Carrera Cup. And Porsche do not do things by halves anywhere in the world of motorsport. So I don't think there's any doubt they'll be contenders in their first year. And who knows, MW could get a Le Mans victory. I'm pretty certain that'd make up for being beaten by Seb Vettel in F1 a couple of times.
Well, yeah, and it's a world championship now, of course. That's another tick in the box. I mean, we have a pretty good and pretty well-informed Australian following for certainly for Le Mans and for some of the World Endurance Championship. We've had David Brabham racing there famously in the past and winning. Will that enhance the interest in the 24-hour race at Le Mans this year, do you think?
I think so. I think it will help gain more mainstream media traction here. 24-hour generally very, very well supported already.
Yes.
And thanks to the likes of David Brabham and the many other Australians that have raced there, it's very well supported in the motorsport industry here. Everyone knows it. The last 5 years it's been shown live on television. I think this year we got 20 hours live on TV, wow, on Speed TV Australia. So I watched about 18 of them, I think. Remarkable race. And it's well known in Australia. It'll help it transition into the mainstream a little bit. It gets mainstream media coverage when something dramatic happens. McNish's crash of a couple of years ago is probably one example. That all played on the national news and the main TV news in Australia. But Tom Christensen winning again didn't. But if Mark Webber wins it, I guarantee you it will get mainstream media exposure here. And look, that's just the way nationalistic sports endeavours go. But yeah, look, I think it'll help. It'll build its brand even further. But it's a well-known race here, John, and you know how many sports car fans there are in Australia.
Do we get the chance to see Creelsey coming across for Le Mans then? You know, given the Australian thoughts about that.
Well, I need to talk to my friends at Porsche Australia about that and see if there's a ticket on offer. But
good mark.
If there's a radio Le Mans gig at the end of it, Heidi, I might be there.
We met, of course, at the Liqui Moly Bathurst 12 Hours. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Formal offer right now on air live. Would you like to come back, John?
Oh, try and stop me. Please try and stop me.
You're locked in. There we go. Deal done. That's how we work in Australia.
I like it.
Agreement over the internet. Perfect.
I'm going to see a few differences to the mountain because, and this will shock a few of our European and particularly British listeners, the local government and the regional government has embarked on a massive improvement program spending. I don't know how much they're spending, but millions of Australian dollars, including a complete circuit reseal and resurface some new, interestingly enough, FIA compliant crash and debris fencing on the pit straight. And pretty much straight after Bathurst, the whole thing's going to get resurfaced.
I was speaking via email with the track manager actually a while back, and he said literally the Monday after the 1000, the bulldozers move in and the surface comes up. So they've only got a couple of months to do 6.2 Ks, and the Bathurst 12-hour, Liqui Moly 12-hour in February, first weekend in Feb next year, will be the first event on a new surface. Now, another famous Australian track, Phillip Island, was resurfaced at the start of this season. Mm-hmm. And since then, lap records have been absolutely smashed. Now, GT3 cars this year were going very, very quickly at the Liqui Moly 12-hour. Changes in regulations for next year's event, there's none of that ridiculous benchmark lap time rubbish that was going on.
Okay.
So basically, cars will be able to go as fast as they like. I don't think there's any doubt if the weather plays the game, we will see lap record times, maybe outright lap record times, currently held by a Formula 3 car, incidentally. The 12-hour is going to be quick. Mm-hmm. If the safety car plays the game, I'm sure there'll be distance and speed records over the course of the 12 hours. It just builds up to an even more tantalising race, given the level of interest that has already come in for it for next year, looking like it'll be a 50-plus grid, probably 20 outright GT3 cars for it as well. So
at least, yeah.
Brand new surface is going to be great. And, yeah, look, full credit, the Bathurst Council, I don't think people even in Australia understand how much that track is part of their town,
yeah,
and how the town lives or dies on what happens at the track. So they invest on it, and they invest a huge amount of money in it, and the state government in New South Wales does as well. So it's an amazing thing, and the facility is just a phenomenal place. You saw it earlier this year.
Brilliant, mate. A $6 million program, safety improvements and infrastructure upgrades, including a lift on the pedestrian bridge from Harris Park into the circuit. The whole of the paddock's going to be resurfaced as well. Spectator fencing, we mentioned, debris fencing, some overhead lighting along pit straight as well. Some changes to some of the other parts of the circuit, which won't change the atmosphere or the nature of the circuit. And when we say $6 million Aussie dollars, I mean, that's a lot of money. But the Western Research Institute Economic Impact Report showed that the Super Cheap Auto Bathurst 1000 alone brought in around $25 million to the local economy. So investing some, yes, but getting more back, I say good luck to them and some British councils who have motor racing facilities on near should be taking a look at that. And a new mayor this year. We met the mayor last year, the mayoress as she was last year. But it's Gary Rush is the new mayor of Bathurst this year and clearly carrying the torch. Creelsey, it's been an absolute pleasure, mate. I'm sorry we've taken up rather more time than we thought we might, but we've got through a lot of ground. Don't get to talk to you too much. Enjoy. Well, I'm going to say enjoy Bathurst. What a stupid thing to say. I'm very envious. I thought there might have been half a chance of me coming down on the way to Fuji, but I think that's evaporating at the moment. But in some way, shape or form, we'll be watching a stream somewhere and wishing I was there.
It's one of the great races of the year, and yeah, we wish you could be here. It needs to be on the Radio Le Mans slate at some stage, surely. I think it might not be a sports car race, John, but I reckon at Bathurst, it's got to qualify, surely.
It's an enduro, and we're all about that, mate. We're all about it. Have a good one, Creelsey. Thanks for joining us, mate. And if I don't see you before, I'll see you at the 12 hour.
It's going to be great. Thanks, mate. It's always a pleasure.
And that is about all we have time for on this rather different Midweek Motorsport this week. I managed not to tell you how to get hold of The Romance of Racing, Andy Holbury with us in the first hour of the programme. If you go to facebook.com and then / Andy Holbury, which is HALLBERY, The Romance of Racing, or you can also email info@romanceofracing.com. And I remember an 18-year-old Dario Franchitti getting his Young Driver Award at in London at the Autosport Awards, and it was, I'm pretty certain, it was Andy Holbury who presented it to him. It also should be available on Amazon from December. Register at that email, info@romanceofracing.com, and you can get it as soon as it's published. It'll be £42 for 136 pages. Beautiful photography and everything that we talked about earlier on. But that's it. There's no time to explain. The Llama clearly has a lot of reading to do.
This programme is a Radio Show Limited production. For more, go to www.radiolemon.com. Radio Show Limited. We talk to the world.